From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Clint Eastwood talks about directing his movie Letters from Iwo Jima. It has Oscar nominations for Best Picture and Best Director, and tells the story of the World War II battle on the Japanese island from the point of view of the Japanese who fought there. Eastwood's companion film, Flags of Our Fathers, is also nominated for Oscars. Plus, playing the man who played Superman, Ben Affleck talks about his starring role as George Reeves in Hollywoodland. The film just came out on DVD. And reviews of the new film Breach and two new TV dramas premiering this weekend. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Clint Eastwood, directed two films last year about the same battle in the South Pacific, and both are up for Academy Awards. Letters from Iwo Jima is up for four awards, including Best Picture, Best Directing, and Best Original Screenplay. Flags of Our Fathers, nominated for Best Sound Editing and Best Sound Mixing, was released first. It showed the Battle of Iwo Jima from the American side, and told the story behind the famous Pulitzer Prize-winning photo of five Marines planting the flag there. That was followed by Letters from Iwo Jima, which portrayed the bloody World War II battle from the Japanese point of view. The Japanese soldiers in Iwo Jima were told to expect to die there, and most of them did. About 20,000 of the 22,000 Japanese troops on the island were killed in the battle. About 7,000 Americans died there. The Japanese general who was chosen to command the battle, Tadamichi Korobayashi, developed a strategy of digging underground caves throughout the island, interconnected by about 16 miles of tunnels. When the Americans invaded, they were attacked by soldiers who remained hidden from view. But the Japanese were outnumbered. More than 70,000 Marines arrived on over 800 ships. The battle lasted 36 days. Terry spoke with Clint Eastwood last month.
Clint Eastwood, welcome back to Fresh Air, and congratulations on your new film. You know, as an American watching the movie, you're in a very almost awkward situation. Usually in a war film, the film is told from your country's point of view, you know, if it's an American movie. And, of course, you're rooting for the soldiers, and you're rooting for them to, vanquish the other side. But in this film, you become very fond of, you know, some of the soldiers and leaders in it. Not all of them, but some of them. And you don't want them to die. And at the same time, you don't want them to kill the Americans who they're fighting. So you can't have a conventional war film response to this movie.
No, absolutely. It's you're not. It doesn't isn't meant to take their side of the story. It's just meant to show that they were in a very tough position by being defenders of a cause that hadn't been working. The Japanese at that time were under the influence of a military complex that was very aggressive, had been very aggressive throughout the world, and now they were on the final defense. And so this is just to show their reaction and what their people like. But when it boils down to is when mothers are losing their sons, the mothers, whether they're Japanese or American or whatever nationality, the reaction is always has the same pathos.
It was really interesting to watch how the Japanese military is portrayed in the film. You know, I think most Americans know that there were, you know, so-called kamikaze fighters during World War II who flew planes right into their target, and the pilots basically committed suicide in the attack. And you portray the kind of emphasis on honor and that killing yourself would be better than surrendering, and better, in some instances, than retreating, as far as the Japanese military higher-ups were concerned. There's a scene in the movie, and I hope you don't feel I'm giving too much away here, but there's a scene in the movie where several of the Japanese soldiers, knowing that they've lost their end of the battle, consecutively blow themselves up with hand grenades that they've kept. And it's just a really kind of shocking and just like disturbing scene to watch them kill themselves like this. Can you talk a little bit, not only about shooting it, but what you had read or heard about this kind of thing happening?
Well, it was quite common in that the philosophy at that particular time and committing seppuku, as they call it, or harikiri, but if you read books, there's a book out called the Kamikaze Diaries that's in English, and it's letters also, letters back from these young students who were conscripted into flying, and they picked these young college students because they could. Figured they'd give them a cram course in flying when they were only going to fly one way. So it was, but the most of the letters are quite pathetic because you uh, you see there, they're writing back and telling their mothers that they really don't want to be doing this and they really don't want to die, and they couldn't resist. The chain of command throughout the Japanese military was very, very strict and very rough, and if you didn't go along with it, you were in deep trouble.
Could you talk a little bit about shooting that scene in which several of the Japanese soldiers blow themselves up with hand grenades?
Well, that actually happened, and we portrayed that, the results of that, in Flags of Our Fathers. But in the Mount Suribachi, there was a point where the Japanese that were stationed in that section of the island felt that there was no hope, and so they just started blowing themselves up, and that's very, very difficult for us to understand in the from an American philosophy. But they actually did that, and that in the book Flags of Our Fathers, they account for that sequence. They chronicle that sequence, and it's kind of an amazing thing. And so in the other one, we showed them leading up to it and how it came about by a misunderstanding, actually, because General Kuribayashi didn't believe in all that. The interesting thing that made me want to tell the story about him was that he didn't really believe in suicide attacks and benzai attacks and all these things that were very common for the Japanese soldiers at that time. He believed that being a dead soldier was not being effective at all. So he was a very practical guy, and he came up with all the ideas of tunneling through the island and connecting tunnels that would make a person be able to get away and fight another day.
The film opens with shots of Iwo Jima today. Can you describe what it looks like now and what it felt like to be there, knowing the casualties in that battle?
Yeah, it is. It's like visiting any battlefield, going to the Utah or Omaha Beach and Normandy and. Or any of those battles here, and you can almost feel the activity there. The first time you walk out on Green Beach, which the Americans named it Green Beach, which is right at the foot of Suribachi, and you walk out there in that deep black sand, and you start thinking about all of the and looking out there and visualizing an armada coming in of American. Ships, it's quite overwhelming, and you think of all the Marine Corps personnel who suffered casualties on that island. It's an overwhelming experience, and then the first we did that the first trip over there, and then later on when you go over there to film, and then you film down in the caves where the hospitals were all built underground in caves, and where the places where the troops resided, you wonder how the hell they did it, because it's amazing. The island is a lot of geothermal activity, so these caves are immensely—they're tremendously hot, and so there's just very humid things. In fact, you go into them now, and they don't recommend you stay in there more than 15 or 20 minutes. But these people had to stay in there for days at a time.
The cinematography is really beautiful. Sounds like the wrong word to use, because we're talking about war here. It's not like it's pretty, but the mood, the tone of it, just seems so right. A lot of the sequences are shot in something very close to black and white. I think that the color is so subdued, it looks almost black and white, although it's very blue-gray more than it is black-white sometimes. But the explosions are in full color. Would you talk a little bit about, like, figuring out what look you wanted the film to have and how you went about getting it?
Well, the film was shot in color, but I sort of desaturated. We desaturated it down to the point where it didn't look comfortable color. We certainly didn't want the picture to have a Technicolor in the old-fashioned sense, Dorothy and Toto in the Wizard of Oz or something. But we wanted to desaturate it down to what it looked almost close to black and white. But the colors were very subdued, and of course explosions are a little brighter because they're explosions. So it was just a question of choices that we all made to have it have that look, which gave it the non-comfortable feeling of war.
Did you meet survivors of the Battle of Iwo Jima from each side?
Yes, I didn't, not from the Japanese side so much. There's not too many of them. Out of the 22,000 men that were stationed on the island, they only 1,000 survived, and we're not sure how many of them were combat folks or whether they were Korean conscripted labor, but there were a few, very few. And we didn't get to talk to too many of them, though I've read articles by some of them that are all quite good. But American survivors, I talked to quite a few of them.
Is there an image that really helped guide you in making Flags of Our Fathers from those conversations you had with survivors?
Well, yeah, there is. There's one image that is kind of common, is that most of them that were in combat there, they just never really spoke about it too much. They would get together and maybe have Marine Corps celebrations or Marine Corps organizations, but they wouldn't really get into the, they didn't, there's not the gung-ho-ness that you'd think there would be. It was a tremendous battle. It was intended to be a 3 or 4 day affair, lasted over a month, and tremendous. They were pinned down a good portion of the way. When you see an awful lot of your friends wounded and killed, it's not something you forget easily.
Clint Eastwood speaking with Terry Gross. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Clint Eastwood. He's the director of the films Letters from Iwo Jima and Flags of Our Fathers, both of which are in contention at this year's Academy Awards.
Did you see a lot of World War II films in the 40s and 50s? And did they have an impact on you?
Yeah, I saw a lot of them when I was growing up. But yeah, they did have an impact on me. They were exciting as a kid to watch war movies, and you're always rooting for somebody, mainly our side, and the enemy was always portrayed as villainous, and our guys were always portrayed as heroic. But those days are gone. I mean, that era was more black and white with it all, and that isn't the way war is to somebody else. So it's fun to look at it from different perspectives, but. And those wars were, those war pictures were mostly propagandistic. They were, they were selling America as great. And that's where the audience was, and that's where it would always be.
Your view of violence in movies has really changed over the years. And some of your early films were very violent, particularly the Sergio Leone Westerns like The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. I mean, those films almost take a certain pleasure in violence, in film violence. And, you know, the last few movies that you've made are just, some of them are so much about the costs of violence, whether it's, you know, in war or on the street. Was there a turning point in your life where you started to rethink rethink film violence and what you wanted to do with it? I mean, I think of the turning point in your movies as maybe being Pale Rider and Unforgiven, but in terms of like what you wanted to do with your gifts when portraying violence on screen.
Yeah, I think I've been interested in that probably. I think it's just a natural maturing of life is at some point you start thinking about things a little different, but differently. But that's part of the growing up process. And I always figured myself, even though I'm in my senior status right now, I still consider myself a person who's growing up. So you're always changing thinking of things in it from a different perspective, and you're looking for stories that think of things from a different perspective. Unforgiven, you mentioned, was a man who was haunted by violence, and so we got into that thing where how it affects you personally and what it does to your soul. And I think now in present times we're looking at World War II, which is easy to look at, but what that has done. What that did to the souls of those men when they came back, and how some of them had a hard time adjusting to civilian life after being asked as very young men at an impressionable age to go off and get involved with violent activity.
If this is too personal, just let me know. You're in your mid-70s now, and obviously still directing great movies. Is getting older, how does getting older compare to what you expected, say, being in your mid-70s would be like?
Well, it's a lot better than I thought it would be. I think that getting older is great if you're constantly learning something, you know, providing you have good health and all the things that everybody wishes for. But you know more. You can look at things from from more perspectives, and you've seen more in life. And it's if you enjoy it properly, it can be a nice experience. A lot of people joke about it. Henry Bumstead, who was an associate of mine, who just recently passed away in his 90s, he used to always say, "Oh, to be 80 again." You know, so it's all a point of it. All depends on where you're looking from. If you're 40, you say, "Oh, 30 wouldn't be bad." Or if you're 80, 70 looks pretty good. But it's a great learning experience at life. And if you keep it as a learning experience, then it's always fun.
You have such an iconic face because of the movies that you've been in. I think all of us, as we get older, we look in the mirror and study how our face is changing with age. And you know, some people decide, oh, well, it's changing. I don't want it to change, so I'll get cosmetic surgery or something. And if you don't, you examine your face changing and you make of it what you will. You know, it's interesting, or you regret it, or, you know, whatever. What's it been like for you with such an iconic face to watch your face change with age? And to watch it on the large screen as well as in the mirror. Yeah.
I don't think one pays that much attention, because it's all a gradual process, and you're this way, and you look this way at this point of life. You're this way, you feel this way at this point of life, whatever it is, and you go on and you enjoy the going on. If you sit there and worry about it and say, "Well, gee, I'll get cosmetic surgery and I'll try to look like I did when I was 28," that ain't going to happen. All it's going to do is make you look like you have a vanity problem with it, and it's not going to be pleasant when people come up to you and say, "Didn't you used to be so and so?" And so it's kind of it would be kind of an embarrassing moment. So I think people have to just accept things the way they are and move on and say that was another phase. Your 30s were one phase, your 40s were one phase, and just keep on going.
Is cosmetic surgery a problem for you as a director, because so many actors have had or are having it done, and you can tell looking at them on a big screen?
It is a problem because if you're casting a person in a film and you say, okay, I'd like to cast so-and-so in part, say, well, now you have to say, well, could you bring him in? Before you could say, well, I know his or her work because I've seen him in many pictures, and so I don't have to see them. I know how good they are. But now you'd say maybe, well, let me see how they are today, because like you say, you're insinuating here, they may not look the same. They come in and they say, Jesus, they're all cosmetized, if that's a word. And there you go. That's not the look I was expecting. That's not what was in my imagination when I thought of casting that person.
Well, Clint Eastwood, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Clint Eastwood, speaking to Terry Gross last month. He directed Letters from Iwo Jima and Flags of Our Fathers, two separate films looking at the same World War II battle from different perspectives. Iwo Jima is up for 3 of the most important Oscars, Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Original Screenplay. The Academy Awards are televised a week from Sunday. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Comes from Barnes & Noble, with the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Harriet Jacobs's Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, sponsoring Philadelphia's new audio walking tours called Sound About Philly at soundaboutphilly.com. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Ben Affleck on his film Hollywoodland about the real-life unsolved murder of George Reeves, the actor who played Superman in the original TV series. Hollywoodland is just out on DVD. Also, David Edelstein reviews Breach, starring Chris Cooper and Ryan Phillippe, and I review 2 wonderful new dramas premiering on cable TV this weekend. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. To start the second half of the show, I'd like to put on my Fresh Air TV critic's hat, which looks like Crocodile Dundee's, by the way, to talk about 2 terrific new dramas coming this weekend on cable. Both of them come from England, both are fabulously acted and written, and both will continually surprise you with their plot twists and emotional depth. One of them is a fact-based telemovie called Longford, premiering Saturday night on HBO. It's about a serial killer serving life in prison in England and a respected politician's unpopular attempts to lobby for her parole. The other is a BBC America miniseries, not based on fact, called The State Within. It's like a shorter British version of 24, and begins with a passenger airliner blown up just after takeoff above Washington, D.C. Let's start with Longford. It's written by Peter Morgan, who's on an incredible run right now. He's up for an Oscar for co-writing The Last King of Scotland, and whether or not he earns an Oscar for himself, he most likely will help Helen Mirren win one for another movie he wrote last year, The Queen. In Longford, Jim Broadbent stars as Lord Longford, a knighted politician whose lifelong passions include visiting and helping to rehabilitate prisoners. When he's asked to come visit Myra Hindley, a convicted murderer played by Samantha Morton, he does, even though she's infamous for the crime she committed with her lover, Ian Brady. In England, Myra Hindley is the equivalent of Charles Manson, and when Lord Longford talks at a family dinner about visiting her, the reaction he gets from his loved ones, even his wife, is totally unsympathetic.
Anyway, she wasn't at all how I might have expected. I found her charming, intelligent, attractive, even.
A woman that murdered three children.
Woman who came under the spell of a man who murdered three children.
That's rubbish.
I spoke to the prison governor afterwards. She's quite convinced that Myra Hindley was corrupted by Ian Brady, and to consider them as equals is a great mistake.
Dada, except that she procured those children, knowing exactly what would happen to them. Never got into the car without a woman present.
The judge made a clear distinction at the trial that Ian Brady was the initiator of these crimes and the actual killer. Myra Hindley was merely a dominated and corrupted accomplice.
Distinction's irrelevant. Murder and accomplice are equally guilty in the eyes of the law.
Killers of this kind almost always have a prior history of offending. Myra Hindley had nothing, not even a blemish.
And wasn't there a tape?
What tape?
At the trial, I seem to remember there was a tape where one heard the dreadful things they did to the little girl. And that it was Myra Hindley's voice one could hear, not Brady's.
No. What about a swim?
Yes, please.
Longford embarks on an uphill battle to gain her release, and the movie becomes a multi-pronged character study. At what cost does he champion her cause? Why does he persist? And most centrally, does she deserve his support? The answers, like the characters, may surprise you. HBO's Longford is one of those rare TV dramas where you end up being as surprised as you are impressed and keep thinking about it afterward. The State Within, which starts the same night on BBC America, is another one. It's a six-hour drama doled out weekly in two-hour chunks. It stars Jason Isaacs as a British ambassador stationed to the United States and Sharon Glest from Cagney and Lacey as the U.S. Secretary of Defense. When an exploded plane above the Capitol seems to have been the work of an Islamic terrorist who's a British national, the governor of Virginia orders that all people in his state with similar backgrounds be rounded up and detained. The British ambassador, the drama's hero, protests the move strongly to the defense secretary, but she defends it just as forcefully.
This is an illegal act. Never mind that it's a breach of international law and shows total disregard for basic human rights.
That is for Congress to decide. As I understand, the governor of Virginia is acting under the powers of the Patriot Act.
We don't even know who was behind the attack. Pakistani fundamentalist, Tirghistani Islamist, Saudi...
The bastard with his finger on the button was British. And from what I hear, there are plenty more queuing up right behind him.
Do you know how many British Muslims there are in Virginia?
It only takes one.
At least 3,000. Holidaymakers, students, business travelers, visa holders. You're saying they're all terrorist suspects? It's an obscene act of racial discrimination.
Obscene? Ask the guys riding your subway who's being discriminated against the next time some wacko decides to detonate himself. Look, I played along with your little stunt out there, all right? All that hot air about strong bonds and unity. But my son did not die in Afghanistan so that our so-called allies can blow themselves up in our own backyard.
The initial explosion and terrorist threat turns out to be just the tip of the iceberg. In The State Within, Isaacs, as Ambassador Mark Bryden, has to deal simultaneously with three different high-profile problems. In addition to the plane explosion, there's a former British soldier scheduled to be executed in Florida, and a newly discovered body pulled out of a river in West Virginia that has its fingertips and most of its face removed, but a tattoo that reads, "Made in Britain." It takes about 2 hours of TV time before we learn that all three events are connected somehow. Takes even longer for the ambassador to learn that. But by that time, The State Within has established so many compelling characters that the rest of the drama, with its high body count and unexpected twists and turns, keeps piling on the pressure until it feels like it's going to explode. Both of these dramas, at their core, are about loyalty and betrayal, and most of all about trust and what it costs. In America, broadcast TV has all but given up on making quality movies and miniseries. But thanks to British productions and imports from HBO and BBC America, we can still see them. Coming up, Ben Affleck. He stars as George Reeves in Hollywoodland, a movie that's now out on DVD. This is Fresh Air. In the film Hollywoodland, which just came out on DVD, Ben Affleck plays the man who played the Man of Steel. George Reeves, the actor who starred in the 1950s TV series Superman, sought fame, but he wanted it through movies, not through playing a superhero in a TV series for kids. The success of Superman took him by surprise, but also, according to the film, made it difficult for him to break out of the role into other parts. Terry Gross spoke with Ben Affleck last fall. His other movies include Chasing Amy, Dogma, Shakespeare in Love, Pearl Harbor, Armageddon, and Good Will Hunting, which he co-wrote with Matt Damon. Let's start with a scene from Hollywoodland, just after Reeves has gotten news from his agent. He's telling the news to the woman with whom he's having an affair, the wife of an MGM executive. She's played by Diane Lane.
Art got a call. They're picking up Superman.
They're what?
Kellogg's. Bought it.
After 2 years?
That's right. I will be on television in a month, wearing brown and gray underpants.
Well, hooray!
Christ.
Well, maybe it wasn't your proudest moment.
No, I'm quite sure it wasn't.
But you did create a very likable, very attractive, very heroic character.
Is that right?
I'd thank you in a second.
Well, one thing we can be sure of. No one with a lick of sense would watch that show.
Ben Affleck, welcome to Fresh Air. When you got the part of George Reeves and you went back and watched again old episodes of Superman, what things about his acting did you notice that you'd never noticed before? Things that you wanted to do too when you were portraying him?
Well, there were a number of things. You know, chief among them was that he had a real sort of a real charm, and it was a kind of a kindness to him, and a kind of sweetness that I think is what kids responded to. And I don't think it's something that you can really fake. That he seemed to have a really good heart, and that he enjoyed this idea and played with this kind of fundamental, central, underlying element of the show that made it, I think, really good at what it was that like, he was sharing this experience with kids, that he was sharing his secret with them and kind of, I mean, sometimes quite literally winking at the audience.
One of the things I think you capture about him as Superman is the way he'd kind of almost plant his feet on the floor, shoulders back, and almost like military-style posture, and then put his like hands on his hips.
There was no, one of the nice things about the period is that there wasn't a lot of pretense, you know. Nowadays, we have a kind of, our heroes have to also be sort of slouching and conflicted.
Exactly.
And have the weight of the world on their head. And right. This, there was no pretense to that. It was like he was Superman. He was proud and strong, and he had his hands on his hips, and he looked out into the middle distance because he was strong and he was going to protect people. It wasn't, you know, this whole idea of like the hero now in movies and stories is, you know, doesn't want to have the curse of these powers, you know, and yeah. He had no such qualms. And even the kind of acting and the behavior style of the 1950s, if you kind of read further into it, there was kind of a presentationalism that was present in acting, which was a kind of self-conscious way of saying, I know I'm about to sit on this couch and smile at this woman, and I'm going to do so in a way that I hope is kind of endearing, you know, like Spencer Tracy, for example, did that really well, or Clark Gable, you know.
And there was even a more formal style of speaking in movies, no matter how informal the characters were supposed to be. And all of this is not your generation's style of acting. So do you feel like you had to change your style of acting and not be conflicted and be more presentational?
Well, playing him in a way, I mean, obviously people still felt the same thing. So one of the things I thought was really interesting about this character was he was a guy who had the same conflicted feelings. In fact, I think George had a tremendous amount of sadness, maybe depression. Definitely he was an alcoholic, probably addicted to pain pills by the end of his life. And he was a very ambitious guy who suffered from the kind of thwarted ambition and the continuing humiliation that that offered. So here's a tremendous amount of pain and difficulty, and yet he's living in a world that really where you have to kind of stiff upper lip and, you know, be gracious and still kind of be charming, because anything less than that is to admit a kind of unimaginable and terrible defeat. So I thought there was something really dramatically interesting. And on the one hand, having a guy who's full of agony and pain, but on the other hand, has to put on a good face.
But when you're playing him as an actor on the set acting,
right,
you have to
as
go
Superman,
into a different, yeah, as Superman, you have to go yeah. into a different acting style.
Absolutely. And one of the things I did to research that was really interesting is rather than just watching him, I watched all his movies, I listened to all his stuff, I watched home videos, I talked to people who knew him, I went through the kind of, you know, the regular steps that you would take, obviously researching somebody. But additionally, I thought, you know, here was a guy who was ambitious and kind of wanted to be other people, right? There's a line which says he'd like to have Clark Gable's career. He is influenced in a way, not as much by who he actually is, but by who he wants to be. So I watched a lot of these movies at the time to see what were the things that he would be emulating. What were the styles that he would be trying to affect in his own performance? And so in effect, I tried to emulate those as he would have. And in doing, I think, ended up with that same kind of style, which, you know, was popular in the 50s, which was to speak really fast. You know, movies would be a lot shorter now if they had that 50s kind of clip of like, say, fella, what do you know? Nothing, chum. I don't know. Hey, back from the war? Sure am. Smoke camels. They're milder. It was like just, you know, very kind of repetitive kind of zipping through your lines. And, you know, picking up on that and playing with that was really fun for me because it was so completely counter to the sort of ultra tape recorder realism, naturalistic style of our time.
What did it feel like to actually put on the famous tights and the famous cape?
It was daunting to a certain extent. We were really concerned with realism in the sense that we wanted to be really consistent with how they did it, particularly in that show, particularly when we're filming, you know, scenes that had to do with either him as Clark Kent or him as Superman, because everybody, you know, who watched the show obviously would have a pretty strong sense of what looked real and what didn't look real, what was, you know, jived with their memory and their sense of how it was, you know, done. And so one of the things I was able to do, there's a television kind of archive memorabilia people here, so have a museum, and I'm forgetting their name, which is a shame because I really appreciated what they did. But anyway, he came by, brought the actual suit that George wore and the rubber foam, you know, muscle suit underneath, and let me not only wear it, you know, not only touch it, but, you know, put it over my head and look at it. And that was a really kind of surreal moment where I was like sort of reaching out and touching the actual clothes that he wore, and you could see all these sweat stains and the thing, and you understood why it was so oppressive. He complained bitterly about it. And as he got more control, interestingly, later on in the series, there was much less of Superman and much more of Clark Kent. He would get these rashes and he would sweat, and, you know, he drank all day while he was doing the show because he was so miserable. And so then he would start to sweat the alcohol, which would like break down the foam rubber, and it was just a disaster. And the outside of the suit, you had this rubber that didn't breathe, and then the you know, tights, as it were, was basically just a wool sweater that was knitted, you know, with the S on it and everything else. And, you know, that combined with the fact that the film was so incredibly slow back then, it needed so much light to be dumped on to in order to be able to see, that, you know, they had these giant, incredibly hot lights. And also they hadn't figured out the technology of keeping lights cooler. So he literally roasted in this outfit. And I wanted to get a kind of a sense of that because everything I read about him, they talked about how incredibly oppressive this outfit was. And I thought that was kind of nicely and, you know, if not too obviously, representative of how onerous he found, you know, playing Superman, and the whole experience was kind of a burden on him.
The film isn't a comedy, but one of the funny lines in the movie is after he puts on his suit for a promotional appearance, he says, and before he walks out and meets his audience of children in this promotional appearance, he says to somebody after putting on the costume, is my penis showing? And I thought, this is exactly the kind of thing that everybody always wondered if he thought about, you know? So is there any evidence he actually said that and wondered about it?
He was a very lively guy, and there's a lot of evidence that he thought about and joked about that kind of thing a fair bit. You know, and he was very, I don't know, ribald or whatever. He, you know, he'd make a lot of jokes about his penis and what could or couldn't be seen, and his, you know, taking his trousers off. And there's a scene in the movie where we do a bit where he actually kind of, what he would do quite regularly, which is kind of like break up on the set by pretending to, you know, like something with Lois where he says, "Do you want to see the real Man of Steel?" And he takes his pants off and he's sort of like pawing at her. And then, you know, the chief comes in and says, "Great Caesar's ghost." And, you know, he says, "More powerful than a locomotive." You know, he was the sexual innuendo and jokes like that, I think, did a lot to, and talking about how obviously foolishly revealing the outfit was, did a lot to kind of mitigate that embarrassment of feeling like a grown adult working on a television show. And as a way, kind of reminding themselves that they were adults, you know, and trying to hold on to their dignity in some way, ironically.
You know, in George Reeves' case, he was typecast in that Superman role and couldn't break out of it. And, you know, a lot of people have drawn parallels to, like, your life in the sense, not that you were held hostage by a role, but by your private life for a period of time because of the whole Jennifer Lopez thing, the whole Bennifer thing. so are there ways in which that you identified with Reeves?
There are a number of ways in which I identify with Reeves. I guess there is a sense, kind of what you're alluding to, is there is a typecasting that happened then, which is about, you know, I can't watch George Reeves in this movie and take him seriously as Captain Stark because I just think of him as Superman, and I can't get that out of my head, and that's all I'm reminded of, so I have no ability to suspend disbelief and follow along with the story. I think there's the modern equivalent of that is similar but not the same, which is you can get typecast as yourself. In other words, audiences become so familiar with, particularly because of the proliferation of all these entertainment kind of media outlets, which is basically, you know, gussied up tabloids, whether in print or in electronic media, that, you know, because there's so many of them and there's this bigger audience, there's a bigger market, they run out of material, so they have to kind of create material, and then they really, you know, they overdo the sort of inane, like the truly pedestrian, to the point where, you know, you really know what, you know, some actor, maybe an actor you don't even like, or whose movies you haven't even seen, how, what they look like taking out the trash, and what their marital status is, and where their kids go to school, and what they look like in the morning before they've put their makeup on, or whatever it is. You get inundated with these images, you know, that it becomes hard to think of the person as a spaceman, or as a, you know, as D.H. Lawrence or something. You just think, that's not D.H. Lawrence. So that's the problem with that kind of typecasting. And I think because I was in a kind of high-profile relationship right around the time when media companies discovered that there was a bigger market for this entertainment pop culture stuff than they thought. And so everybody knew, as you say, that's this like a nickname for a relationship or, you know, details about a relationship that seem, it's just kind of, you can't believe other people know those sort of things about somebody else. It's like stuff I don't know about, you know, good friends of mine.
Yeah, well, the idea of being typecast as yourself so that people can't believe you playing a role is really interesting, and that certainly rings true. You know, in playing George Reeves in Hollywoodland, he's actually having an affair through the movie with the wife of an MGM studio executive. And the press basically doesn't cover that, and there's another studio executive whose job it is to make sure that stories like that don't get covered, that the stars are protected. So did you think a lot about the difference between press coverage of movie stars then and now?
Yeah, I thought I yearned for those days. I thought, how wonderful would it be? How much better would my life have been? Career, everything, psychological well-being, if there was some, you know, velvet hammer enforcer guy who every time the press wanted to write something about, you know, ugly about someone's personal life, they just went around and broke their ankles. The idea is just so appealing.
Ben Affleck speaking with Terry Gross. His movie Hollywoodland has just come out on DVD. Coming up, David Edelstein on Breach, the new film about Robert Hansen, the treasonous FBI agent who sold secrets to the Soviets. This is Fresh Air. The director, Billy Ray, won acclaim for his unsparing portrait of journalistic fabricator Stephen Glass in the film Shattered Glass. In Breach, he profiles a more dangerous deceiver, former FBI agent Robert Hansen, who was sentenced to life imprisonment in 2002 for selling secrets to the Soviets over a 15-year period. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Billy Ray's last movie, Shattered Glass, and his new spy drama, Breach, have the same kind of lurid appeal. The central figures of both films are pathological liars, and we know going in that both men will get nailed. But if that knowledge takes away some of the suspense, our superior vantage gives us time to scrutinize these wrongdoers as their worlds implode, to study them like specimens in a jar. In Breach, Chris Cooper plays the real-life FBI traitor Robert Hansen, and he's weirder than any Star Wars creature. We see him through the eyes of an aspiring agent named Eric O'Neill, played by Ryan Phillippe, whose assignment is to work as Hansen's assistant and keep tabs on him while the Bureau waits to catch him passing secrets. The thing is, it's really hard to spy on a world-class paranoiac. And Hansen is extra wary. After more than a decade of supplying the Soviets with, among other things, the names of their own turncoats, Hansen seems to sense that this is the end game, the final reckoning. Chris Cooper is outlandishly great. Watch him trudge down the corridors of FBI headquarters with a face that's all wattles and pouches and scary hollows, with the look of a man trying not to scream while being nibbled by piranhas. Watch his eyes dart around as he enters a room, registering scores of tiny details. He could snap at any moment, as you can hear when he takes Eric out to the woods for a bit of impromptu interrogation and target practice.
I test you at 25 yards, 15 yards, 7 yards, and 5 yards.
What are you doing?
You want to be an agent or don't you? Prone, left hand, right hand. 5 yards with gun in holster. You get 3 seconds to fire 5 shots.
What are you doing?
Who is calling you in the car?
What?
I need to know if I can trust you.
Put the gun down.
I need to know if I can trust you!
One of many scary things about that scene is Hansen's fixation on his marksmanship. His bitterness toward the FBI comes from his conviction that the intelligence guys like him can't rise to the top. It's the ones who came up as cops, who can shoot, who become the directors. Being passed over is one motive for betrayal, and director Billy Ray touches on others. Hansen is the son of a sadistic father and the husband of an extremely devout Opus Dei Catholic, played by Kathleen Quinlan. Maybe he needs to act out to be a bad boy for once. At a certain point, though, the director gives up on the single motive theory. Hansen defies explanation, Freudian, Jungian, or Martian. Chris Cooper lifts Breach way above the realm of an ordinary spy picture, but Ryan Phillippe knocks it down a peg. After establishing right off the bat that Hansen has extrasensory perception when it comes to sussing out lies, the director allows Phillippe to lie badly. That is, to lie like an unimaginative actor who can't help signaling the audience that his character is in a panic. It hurts Cooper's performance to make him watch that kind of obvious dissembling and not react. Phillippe has another scene, a supposedly furtive meeting with his FBI handler, played by Laura Linney, where he yells and carries on like an actor seizing the moment. That's a big mistake, too. It hurts Linney's performance to make her watch that kind of emoting and not say, "Keep your voice down, moron. You're a spy." Linney is such a smart actress, though. Her frosty demeanor early on sets you up for how her character will soften and show a little emotion when the end is finally in sight. The last part of Breach is terrifically tense, in part because director Ray is so good at capturing the psychological essence of an ecosystem, in this case, an ecosystem riven by territorial disputes. Hansen despises the very atmosphere that allowed him to flourish as a spy. The problem, he tells O'Neill, is that cooperation is viewed as counter-operational. You hear that and wonder if the FBI's worst traitor had the insight to be its best director.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Fresh Air is now available as a podcast. Just visit our website, freshair.npr.org. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from The Dial Press, publisher of In the Country of Men, a novel about a young boy living under the shadow of Gaddafi's Libya by Hisham Motter. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. And from Warner Home Video, presenting The Departed on DVD and high definition, including two documentaries on a two-disc set available today. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the President's Day edition of Fresh Air, we look at the history of presidential campaign ads with film curator David Schwartz. Also, presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin, whose most recent book is Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln. Join us for the next Fresh Air.